Hi everyone, it's Stephanie. Welcome or welcome back to the Sit Down with Steph podcast. I'm so excited for you to listen to today's conversation I had with my friend and mentor, Talitha. Talitha is a research fellow at Deakin University in Australia, and I've known her for, I want to say, at least half a year. We've been working together through a mentorship program. She's been giving me a lot of advice. We've met a lot and we really become friends. So I decided she'd be a great person to have on the show to talk about a lot of things, as she actually does have a PhD. And we discussed things like university advice, imposter syndrome, mentorship, and so much more. I really did have a great time recording this conversation and talking to Talitha. I hope you guys enjoy listening to it as much as we enjoyed recording it. And without further ado, let's just get into the episode. Okay, everyone, welcome back. Today I'm here with a very special guest. Today I'm here with Talitha, who is my mentor and a research fellow at Deakin University, which is the coolest part is actually that Talitha is from Australia. So I think that's awesome. Talitha, I'm so excited. Thank you so much for coming on to my podcast.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
No problem. So do you want to just share a little bit about yourself so the listeners can kind of know who you are?
Yeah, sure. So I am, as Stephanie said, a research fellow at Deakin Uni in Melbourne in Australia. I started off, I grew up a bit in the country, in a country town called Mildura, which is about 6 hours driving away from Melbourne. And then when I finished high school, moved to Melbourne to do an undergraduate in psychology and psychophysiology. I was really interested in psychology mostly, but also the physiological processes that go into, the way we behave. And then I took a bit of time off. So I did my 3-year undergrad and I took a bit of time off. I worked in hospitality for a couple of years. I went traveling in Europe for a couple of years. And then I came back to do an honours year, which I think is a bit similar to the master's in Canada, and in the US as well. So did an honours year, so that's basically the 4th year and it's a project, and I finished that and did pretty well. So I got into a PhD program at Swinburne Uni, also in Melbourne. And that was my four years of joy, a lot of stress and a bit of trauma, but got through the other end. And now I worked at Swinburne for a couple of years as a postdoc and then got a fellowship at Deakin. So I'm running my own research projects at Deakin Uni now.
Awesome. Yeah. That's so exciting. I mean, that's why you're super qualified to talk about all the things we have planned today. So that's really cool. And I mean, you might be thinking, like, the listeners might be just like, how do they know each other? But it's actually an interesting story because we got paired through a mentorship program for a neuroscience platform. Like, they actually reached out and followed me on Instagram, and Talitha, I know you like had known the platform as well, and you kind of through social media mentorship and just like automatically paired mentors with mentees. So I was paired with Talitha, and I think this was a solid half a year ago. Like, I say it's definitely been like 6 months that we've known.
I think it's been a while.
For sure. It definitely has. We meet all the time. And so that's why Talitha is my mentor. And that's how I know her, because otherwise I have never been to Australia. So that is, I think it's super cool.
I've never been to Canada.
Right. So I mean,
on the list.
We bash things like the pandemic and like all this online stuff. But at the end of the day, like, this is how we were able to meet. And I think it's so cool that technology and stuff connects people from all over the world. So I'm really grateful for that.
Totally agree.
Yes.
Yeah, likewise.
Awesome. So before we get into our episode, I have to do this, I guess, standard question that I ask all of them. The question is, what is the best piece of advice you have ever received?
I had to think about this one a lot because I feel like I've received so much really good advice over the course of my whole life. But I think the biggest thing, and especially more recently, have been told, and it's been reinforced constantly with a few, grant rejections and papers being thrown back and some disappointments. that it, not to take things personally in the work space. So there are lots of things that will, you'll feel like you'll set you back, and it's really important not to take those as a reflection on you as a person and how good you are and how worthy you are, because that is really damaging, as you could imagine.
Yes.
To someone's mental health, to be taking all of that really personally. So yeah, to as much as you can, create space between you as a person and your work and what you're achieving at work and in a work situation. They're very, very separate things. So I think, yes.
I like that a lot. I think that's really good.
Yeah.
This question, I love asking it. Love the answers. That was just an example. One of the
awesome. It's a good question. It's a hard one.
I know.
A hard one, but a good one. Yeah.
I'm in like the lucky position where I ask the question, I don't answer it, because honestly, I really would have to think about it. So I'm just.
Someone needs to flip that around on you one day.
Oh my goodness. Someone might come on and do that. I have to be ready to start thinking now.
Yeah. Ben, prepare. Yeah.
Yes. But awesome. So we got that out of the way. Let's get into the episode. So what we did was we've just prepared some topics that we think would be interesting and we're going to talk about, and we'll just kind of see where the conversation takes us. So the first thing we wanted to discuss is a little bit about Talitha's journey. So she kind of shared with us her journey from student to where she is now as a research fellow at Deakin University. I feel like she's super qualified to give some advice on some of the stuff because she's been in school for a while, and you know, you've really seen it all at all levels of school, I feel like. So I think the first thing that I'd love to hear about is some advice that you would have for people who may not know what career path they want to pursue.
I think, I spent a bit of time thinking about this too. My journey has been probably not a standard sort of progression through the stages, given I took some time off. And even during high school, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I just really knew that my parents were both involved in kind of in education, but my mum's a kindergarten teacher, so she had lots to do with early childhood development. And my dad was a counsellor in school, so he saw lots of kids that were struggling with different issues and lots of kids that had neurodevelopmental conditions that meant that they struggled a little bit more than other kids. And I was just always really curious about what it was that caused or led to these kinds of difficulties that kids have, and then how that ends up affecting the rest of their lives as well, because in many cases it doesn't just go away when you finish school. Like, you've got to then function as an adult and do quite well, or try to fit into the mold that we have in society. So I knew that I was really interested in that kind of that progression and trying to understand what might cause or contribute to ways different people struggle with different things, and that's what got me really interested in psychology. And then I thought I wanted to be a developmental psychologist or a sports psychologist, because I was also really interested in like sports and physical activity and how the body works. So that's where the psychophysiology thing came in, because I was really interested in then how the different processes in your body and brain affect your psychology, which is why I chose that course. So I got through that, the first 3 years of that, and I guess moving from country town to city, not that Melbourne's like huge on the standards to the rest of the world, but you know, a few million people.
Fair enough.
It was a big change. Big change when you're 17 to move far away from your parents. And so it took, like, integrated quite well, and I really enjoyed it. But I really just needed to take some time off after that, because I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do afterwards. And I did end up working doing some early intervention stuff with kids with autism as one of my jobs as well when I finished my undergraduate. So I think I've kind of got a little bit off track a bit, and then moved into hospitality, which is totally different. And that was really good to just like break free and do something different for a while and get a bit of management experience and other life experiences going traveling.
Yes.
So I think that break was really important in making me realize that I wanted to come back and do, really get back into that space. I was really interested in autism as a condition, as a spectrum condition, interested in how it manifested across the whole population. So not just people who are clinically diagnosed with autism, but also how autistic traits are present in the general population and what the brain processes were involved in that. So I think overall, advice-wise, because that was the question, I think overall, really being open to different possibilities, exploring different options. Don't feel like you need to stay on the same set path. If you're really unsure, try a few different things, give it a good go. And if you're really not feeling like it's for you, then also don't be scared to move away and step out of that if it's not working for you, and try something different. I think a lot of people get caught up in maybe there are expectations from others around them or even for themselves to be a certain person or do a certain thing. And I mean, that has its place, and it definitely works for some people. But for a lot of people, I think it can just lead to a lot of disappointment in life and not feeling like they're really being who they are. So yeah, being open and free and ready to change tracks if that's what's right for them.
Right. I think that's really good. The reason why I kind of asked this question is because I remember a little while ago when we initially kind of spoke, you told me that, you know, I didn't really plan on, you know, getting a PhD or like.
Not at all.
And I think that's so interesting because like oftentimes we look at people who have that high level of education and we think, oh, like this must have been, you know, a master plan from like elementary school, and you know exactly what you want to do with your life. And we think like, wow, these people really have it all figured out. And I love to hear that, like, it's something that kind of just happened. It's not like you had this so planned out and you kind of went with it. You took your own advice and you took your breaks, you tried new things, and then ultimately this is the road that it led you to. And I think that's so cool and so great to hear.
So. Yeah, it's definitely not in the plans. It kind of just all evolved. I mean, I was very lucky. I had a lot of really good experiences during my education and met some really great people that helped to facilitate that progression. So it kind of made it not easy, because there's nothing easy about doing a final year and PhD, but it was definitely smoother than, I don't know, for a lot of people. Yeah.
That's good.
And having learned lots of advice from different people as well was really important. Yeah,
for sure. I think we will talk about things like mentorship a little bit later. So I think that's a good little hint of what we're going to discuss later on. But something else that I wanted to kind of know is you were in university for a while. So, I mean, I'm kind of asking this question for myself too, in a sense, if I'm being completely honest. I'd love to know your best tips for university success, because I think, you know, high school and elementary school, it's school, but it's like a little bit less intimidating. Mm. But then when students get to like any level of university, it's like, okay, this is the big leagues. Like I need to, you know, buckle down and study and do all these things. We forget about balance. So, I mean, I just love to know your tip on university success and what to do, I guess, to be as successful as possible.
Yeah, it's a really great question, and I don't know that I have like the answers, because I don't think I was, especially my undergrad, I mean, I wasn't the most academic. This is probably another fun fact about me. I wasn't hugely academic as a kid. Like I really struggled with reading. I've never been diagnosed, but I'm sure I've got some mild level of dyslexia, because it takes me forever to read everything. I think I learned about really good study habits during high school, which I think served me really well. This is in contrast to my brother, who was like naturally just so smart, and he didn't learn any good learning habits and didn't do that great in his final years. So I think, definitely learning good study habits early is key. work at what works for you. Some people are really awesome with rote learning, and other people just cannot do that in any way. So find your strategy and hone it in and try to stick with it. But also, like I said before, be really flexible with trying new learning styles, because I think that'll lead to more success. Once you've decided on what you're doing, even though I said, you know, be flexible and try different things, once you're doing it, like if you've enrolled in a subject, probably best just to like stick that out for the rest of the semester and don't, or trimester, and don't get like, you know, halfway through and go, oh no, don't want to do this anymore, and flunk it, because I think it's just a massive, it'll just be a huge waste of time for you and for everyone else. So see it out and then make a decision about whether it's really for you. Make friends. For people, I mean, I think this was easier for me, well, not easier, but because I moved cities and I didn't know many people, and I certainly didn't know anyone in my course, I made friends with people in my course. It just kind of happened because we were in the same orientation week group. So gravitated to a few people and then study with them. So because they're all doing the same subject as you, it's really awesome to have people that you can sound ideas off, study with, and especially when it comes to assignment writing, those sorts of things. I'm not meaning copying, obviously, but at least having someone else to just be a bit of a sounding board, and then you're not isolated by yourself, it won't feel so lonely. Especially at university level, because during high school, everything is more, I guess you're Stephanie and I were talking about this the other day, kind of not spoon-fed, but definitely the teachers are there to help you succeed and get you into university. So they're there and they provide you not so much like exactly the answers to the exam questions, but, you know, they're guiding you directly through that process, and they're with you the whole school week. With uni, it's really self-directed. And I mean, the lecturers and teaching assistants are there for you. They're there to help you, but they're not going to seek you out to see if you're doing okay. So if you're really struggling with something, definitely reach out to lecturers or teaching assistants. Don't expect the world from them, because they also are very busy people. But there's also other supports at your universities as well, and use them. Like if you struggle with writing, find someone that can help you with writing, because it's that's what it's there for. Yeah, that's pretty much. Don't party too much. That's probably the other thing. Like if you party a little bit, but don't go wild. Don't go too wild too often, because you still need to like get through the other side.
Right. It's like you go to university. Yeah. That's freedom. But it's like, let's
yeah. You've got to balance that.
You know, don't do part of it. But yeah. Definitely don't just.
If you want to do well, yeah. If you want to do well, you've got to limit that too. Like, it's all about balance. I'm not going to, like, I had quite a fun time. But I didn't do, it wasn't like week long benders. So, you know, you can curb that in.
No, I think balance is very important.
Yeah, balance is so important. Eat well, exercise, all of that other normal stuff too. Get lots of sunshine when you can, when it's not like snowed in.
Yeah, for sure. I agree, definitely. Those are really helpful. I think I'm going to keep those in mind myself.
I think I do too.
Honestly, no, it's good advice. I think like it can apply to so many areas of life, but I'm going to take it for university school specifically right now. But yeah, I think the next little thing that I wanted to discuss is, I feel like there are so many, like I call it myths kind of, but I feel like people have so many misconceptions about like a PhD and like PhD students and anyone who goes and gets that higher education. So I'd love it if we could like debunk some of the most popular, I guess, PhD myths right now.
Yeah. All right. I think the biggest one for me is that everyone now thinks that I'm a genius across everything. Like I must be the smartest person because I have a PhD. And I was doing trivia with my friends the other day via Zoom, because that's how we do it these days. And I scored the worst. Like I was terrible. And even one of my friends was like, Talitha coming in last as the only doctor in the room. And I was like, guys, just because I've got a PhD doesn't mean I'm super smart in every single way. Like, I don't know what, you know, such and such played in whatever movie. So definitely that. I know a lot about one very, very specific thing. And I think there are a lot of PhD students and people with PhDs who are incredibly brilliant and do know a lot about a lot of things. So I'm not saying that all PhDs are not, but definitely there are quite a few PhDs that don't know everything. Yes. The other one I think is that, and this is controversial because it's almost a bit like a rite of passage kind of thing, but there's a lot of hype, I want to say, around doing a PhD being like having to work 24/7 and it's, you know, it's your job to be present at your workplace for, you know, 20 hours a day and working overnight and doing all-nighters and those sorts of things that I think are really unhelpful, because it is possible to do a PhD and have balance, and it's really important to do a PhD and have balance, because otherwise you just burn yourself out and you're not helping anyone. So I think that's probably the most important thing that I've picked up over the years. And sure, there are times where you will have to work on weekends because you've got something due or you've got a deadline for something, something important like a grant, or you've got to get some paper back, manuscript back with submission edits, or any of those things. Or if you're working in a wet lab with, you know, doing animal studies and you've got to keep, you know, your rats alive, then obviously you've got to do what you need to do to keep them alive.
Yes.
Or if you're doing overnight studies with them, then there are times where, definitely the workload is heavier and you just kind of need to ride through that. But definitely try to find the balance on the other side, because I think it's almost glorified, like it's this glorified overwork situation that I think is really, really, really unhelpful. Because if you've been working for 10 hours already today, as if that extra 2 hours is going to be at all productive, and if it just means you look good to your supervisors or your colleagues or whatever, then I think you really need to just take stock and double check your priorities, because your mental health and physical health will suffer.
I think
significantly.
Yes.
You're going to be doing that for 4 years.
I can only imagine, but I think something that I'm gathering is just the importance of balance and the fact that, like, even when you're doing a PhD program, you can and should strive to always have that balance in your life, because I've talked about this before. I think, you know, it can lead to things like burnout, and we want to enjoy what we're doing, and, you know, let's just try and have a good balance with all aspects of our life so we can just be the best versions of ourselves.
That's right.
Yeah, for sure. I think, I mean, you mentioned a little bit about grants, and I think it's a good segue into kind of a day in the life of the researcher. I think, like, I would love to know. I mean, I'm also a lot of these questions I'm asking for my own personal interest, but I think, I mean, I hope that listeners would find it interesting. I just think that it's so, like, interesting to hear about what a typical day for you is like. So I don't know. I know it's probably not, you know, the same thing every day like it is for, like, a standard 9-to-5, like, corporate job. You go in and you do this.
Yeah.
But, like, on average, I guess, like, what would a typical day or, like, a week or normal things that you would usually do, what would those look like?
Yeah, I think this is the thing I love the most about this job, is that it's so diverse. There are so many different things that I wear, so many different hats in this job. I guess primarily as a research fellow, that means that I secured funding for myself, for my salary, and then also for a research project. So a fellow typically is working on a project, and I don't do any teaching as part of that. So at the moment I'm not teaching. I did some teaching as part of my PhD for money. But at the moment I'm only doing research. So in that role, my primary focus is my research project, which is unfortunately requires recruiting human participants to come into a lab for testing, which obviously doesn't happen in the middle of a pandemic. So we've had a bit of a difficult 18 months in that respect. I think I've got about 4 people through, which is really disappointing. And with my contract ending in March, it's kind of feeling a little bit disappointing. But it's okay, we'll deal with that. So running that project basically means I've actually got a research assistant that helps me with that now as well. So she's doing lots of the advertising for the study, recruitment and testing when we can. But then I'll be in charge of doing all of the data analysis of that one and writing up the papers and submitting them to journals. So hopefully we get enough data to be able to do that. And if not, I don't know what's going to happen. It's just an unfortunate situation. So that's that's my main focus, but obviously I'm not doing that. I can't be doing that all the time, especially if we can't actually be doing any testing. So the rest of the time I'm looking for research funding to be able to continue my position as a research fellow. So because I'm on a fellowship, it's a short period of time, or it was a 2-year fellowship, and I had 9 months off for maternity leave last year. So I had a little baby last April, which is also an awesome time to be having a kid in the beginning of the pandemic. It's great. Yep, that wasn't part of the plan. So I took, I had time off last year in the depths of the pandemic until November, and then I came back part-time. So my contract itself has been extended, which is nice, until March. But after that, it ends. And after that, I don't know where, what, how I'll be employed and with what money. So my job, if I want to continue being primarily a researcher, is to find grants that will pay me a salary as well as give me research funding, which is really hard. And I've just, at least when this podcast is released, it won't be under embargo anymore, but I've just found out that I wasn't successful with that grant that we were talking about, Stephanie. Which is, I mean, not at all surprising, because I think this year the success rate is usually only 10%, and this year is probably going to be worse because there's less money. It's a government-funded grant and there's less money. The government doesn't have money to be spending on neuroscience research because pandemic. So now I don't really know what I'm going to do, but I'll be looking for a job. So day in the life of me is partly also going, where am I going to find future employment? But the more enjoyable things, because that's really not so fun, it's just like low level stress, the more enjoyable things are supervising students. I have a PhD student and 2 honours students at the moment. The honours students will be submitting soon. My PhD student only started this year, so she's got a few more years. And that's definitely that, and mentoring, which is not exactly my job, but I'd like to tie it in a little bit. One of my favourite things. My other favourite thing is data analysis. So because everything in the data collection side of my current project has sort of fallen aside, I've been digging through my PhD data again, because I collected a lot of different types of data, and there's some of it I haven't analysed in, like I've been trying to find time to do it, and now I feel like it's the right time because I need to be productive in some way. So digging back through some data and also analysing data from other people's studies that I've been involved in. So they're my favourite things, and they analysing, it's neuroimaging data, so it's like kind of heavy stuff and need to get in the zone, and I really love it. And then this is a lot of things. This is like a week in the life of me, 3 days a week. and then I have a few service roles as well. So I'm part of a university is that you kind of also need to, like, I'm 100% research, but really I've got a responsibility to be involved in service to the university and to the scientific community as well. So I am on the faculty human research ethics committee. So I do, once a month, I'll do an ethics review and ethics application, a low risk one, which is always interesting to see what other people are doing and to kind of fine tune my ethical compass. I'm on a number of scientific committees as well, especially in particular the Australasian Cognitive Neuroscience Society. I'm involved in their conference organisation as well, so that takes up a bit of time each week. Not a huge amount, but you know, enough. And I'm the professional development coordinator for our lab as well. So there are a few different things that I'm involved in each week, and it's very, very diverse and dynamic and fun. Except the grad stuff, but it's fun.
Just a couple, but I think that's what makes it, like, I know you were joking about it, you're like, oh, you know, there's so many different things, but I think that's really cool, and that's what makes it interesting, because oftentimes when we, like, when people have these standard jobs where everything's so set for them, and it's so, like, similar every single day for so many years, that can get so boring because it's so predictable. And I think,
yeah, I think a lot of people thrive with that, but I definitely can't. And I've played with the idea of leaving that academic space a few times, especially this year, given the funding situation and just not knowing, and the stress, sometimes stress with grants and keeping up and keeping your track record, like your CV looking awesome with all your publications. There's a lot of pressure on that. And I hate that side of it. I hate the competitive nature of it. So I'm like, what if I just got a desk job? But I just know that I'd be so bored. So, you know, you can't have it all. I'll take the stress and stay in the dynamic, fun space of research instead.
Yes, I think, I definitely think that you're in the right place for you. And I mean, don't get me wrong, there are people who totally thrive in that, and like,
yeah, and good for them.
That, yes, yeah. For sure. I think, like, it's, again, it's all about, you know, whatever works best with you. You stick with that, like Talitha said, you commit to it, and then you just continue on in that area, unless things get really bad, then you can like change. But
yeah, you can always leave, and it's always worth having. A friend of mine calls it, I think she called it the academic exit plan. So she always had in the back of her mind what she might like, just thinking about what she might like to do. And she's still in data science, so it's not like she moved, you know, just to come something completely different. But I listened to, she was on a podcast recently, and I was listening to her. I was like, academic exit plan. All right. So cool. And then her job became redundant at the beginning of the pandemic because the university didn't have enough money to keep her on. So she was like, activate, academic exit plan, and then did all of the things she needed to do to move into a different job. So, you know, it's always there. There's always the possibility to move elsewhere if it's really getting too much.
You know, like specifically the way it's phrased, like activate academic exit plan.
I know. That's so cool. It's like, I want to do that. And then I thought, no, I don't.
I think it's really smart. I mean, that's good advice, like for anyone to just have that even in the back of their minds. Like if
you
don't think, you know, maybe you're not going to leave your current position, or like this can even be applied in a school context. Like say you chose your degree, like
yep.
Have to be set in stone. You can always think, okay, you know, if things were to not go exactly how I planned them, what would be something else that I'd be interested in? There's absolutely no harm in doing that. I think it's better. It's like a little safety net, but it doesn't mean you have to use it, but at least it's just there for you in the event that you do need it. I really like that. Like press the red button, activate.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's right. Yeah. And if you're feeling like, because I definitely have, I will talk about this soon, but I feel like, I think another thing with PhD and myth busting is that we only have, like, if you've got a PhD, you've just got one set of skills, and you don't really, you can't, those skills aren't really transferable to other things. But really, they are, because a lot of the stuff you learn during a PhD is very transferable to a number of different industries in terms of like project management and time management and presentation skills. And there are all these other things that come along with what you're learning just in your day to day, even though you feel like you know nothing. Because you're surrounded by people that are way smarter than you, you're actually learning a lot. And if it takes talking to like a careers advisor or a psychologist, I saw my psychologist about it, because, and she was like, no, you could get a job many places. These are the things you know now, and these are the things, this is the stuff that you can do. You're actually, yeah, very employable. And I was like, okay, thanks. That's good to know. So just having someone to be able to boost that confidence, I think, is really important as well. Yeah, make you actually feel like you could go somewhere else. Otherwise, you just end up being stuck in where you are and miserable.
I think it's very important.
Hopefully not.
Right. You bring up a really good point. I mean, this is the next thing that we kind of wanted to talk about a little bit, and it's called imposter syndrome. So you kind of defined, and when I say imposter, I just want to make it clear, not imposter like Among Us the game. This is something a little bit different. So imposter syndrome, I'm not going to give the definition on this. I'm going to ask Talika to give the definition because you definitely know a little bit more about it than me. So what exactly is imposter syndrome, maybe for some listeners who aren't completely sure about what it is?
It's a bit of, since we were talking about it the other week, I've done a little bit of extra reading about what it is and where it came from. And I've heard it thrown around a lot in this industry, and I think in the academic space, but I think also it goes across many, many industries. It was defined like in the 70s, I think, by some psychologists as just generally doubting, like having this underlying or overwhelming feeling of doubting yourself and your abilities. And like everyone else is smarter than you, and you're just going to get found out eventually that you're totally not smart enough to be doing this job. And it's definitely, that's a feeling that I have often. And the more I talk about it, that feeling, not necessarily the imposter syndrome like label, but that feeling, it more and more people have been talking about it. And there was a survey that went around on Twitter for academics is quite a thing. So if I talk about being on Twitter, it's because I'm in the academic space, not others. But it was like an overwhelming amount of people. There was this questionnaire, people responded to it. It was like, people were just saying, oh my gosh, I'm like on the highest of this scale. So I think because everyone's surrounded by people that are way smarter than, or they feel like are way smarter than them constantly, then you just continue to feel like you're just so dumb, and that everyone's smarter than you, and eventually they'll find out that you're really dumb, and that'll be really hard to and really embarrassing. So I think it's very, very common in the academic space to feel like you're not smart enough and that other people are smarter than you. And it's, the more I read about it, the more I kind of realized that perhaps it's a bit, and this is going to be extremely controversial, but it's a little bit, I think it's more prevalent in women. It's more prevalent in people who are in minority groups within their like work spaces. So it's possibly more a product of not being like of covert racism and sexism and that sort of stuff in the workplace as well. And I don't want to get anyone on, like, I don't want to annoy anyone. This is all just my very novice reading. But it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's like, it's a feeling that you're not good enough, and probably you are good enough, and probably you're quite good at what you do, and that should be encouraged. It's common to feel that way. So I think, I'm not entirely sure, and I still have this feeling of imposter syndrome often, but I think that the remedy for it is to surround yourself with people, especially your supervisors, bosses, mentors, who are committed to your success, essentially, and who are encouraging you in ways that are reinforcing your qualities and your skills. And I'm not saying, surround yourself with people that are like, you're awesome, you keep doing what you're doing, but more really recognizing the value in what you can add to a workplace or a research lab or whatever it is. So it's, not token you're great, but really, that was really awesome how you did this thing. And I think I've been really lucky to have people like that in my professional life, who constantly, like, I've got terrible self-esteem and huge self-doubt, and like ask my partner, he'll be like, yeah, she's shocking. So I feel like more than most people, I need that extra bit of reinforcement. But it's good to just continue to be involved in, like, push yourself to don't like go and wallow in self-pity and be like, oh, I'm terrible at my job and I can't do anything. You also need to put yourself out there and be really proactive. So if you're invited to give a talk, give a talk somewhere, or if you have been, if you've got the opportunity to be involved in like scientific committees or ethics committees or on professional development teams or whatever, do it, because it's really important that all those little bits of experience will help to boost your confidence. Yeah, I don't know if that's helpful, but it's something that I think is worth recognizing as a real feeling that a lot of people feel. And yeah, just especially when you're moving into something new like university or a new job or whatever it is, yeah, there needs to be that recognition that it's there and that there are things you can do to help.
Right.
Calm that feeling down.
Yes. No, I completely understand. I've experienced this. I've heard other people talk about this. It's a very real thing. Sometimes we don't know exactly how to coin the feeling, but just imposter syndrome, that's what it is. And I'm sure many listeners have experienced this as well. I think it comes from our perception and how we see like ourselves. So I think something else that I would add, because I really like your like quote unquote remedies spoken like, but I think I would say something else that you can definitely do, and it's more of like a thing you can do right now, is to kind of shift your perspective. So step back and look at everything that you've done in your life as if you're your own friend or your parent or someone else in your life, not yourself, because the saying you're your harshest critic is so true.
It's so true. Yeah.
What you've done from something else. I don't know, maybe write a list if that's your thing, or type it out on the computer and just write out, you know, the things that you've done in your life that you're most proud of. And then look at that list as if you were, I think a friend is a really good thing to do, because if you saw like someone else, your friend achieving success, you'd be like, wow, you know, like this is so amazing. I think when it's ourselves, we're just so harsh because we always expect more and more and more from ourselves. So take a step back, shift your perspective, and look at that list as if you were your own friend. And I think when you do that, it helps you realize like, wow, I really have done a lot of cool stuff. Maybe I do deserve to be at this school or be in this position. Like looking at this, it makes me realize like I am smart and I am capable. And it's kind of like those affirmations too. Then you almost hear that in your head and you're reminding yourself of these things. And I think the more you believe that, the better you'll feel and the less of an imposter, quote unquote, you'll feel like. So I mean, that's my own take. Try it out. Definitely let me know if it works. It's kind of something I just thought up on the spot, but.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think it's a really good, it's a really good point. And I, can imagine that would be really effective for people. Come on.
Love to know if it works for anyone. So definitely, you know how to reach me. DM me on the Instagram, tweet me on the Twitter, the podcast, social media. I'm everywhere. So let us know. We would love to know. Okay, so that is everything we have for the section on imposter syndrome. And the final topic that we prepared to talk about is mentorship and the value of having a mentor. And I think this is a really cool topic to discuss because it does relate to our relationship so perfectly, because we did meet through a mentorship program. And I know a lot of people are very interested in mentorship and maybe they want to have a mentor, but they could be unsure about how to get one, build that relationship, like all these things. So we can kind of talk about that. Like I said in the beginning, we met through a program. So they got a bunch of applicants for the mentees, a bunch of applicants for the mentors. They asked us about our interests as well. So we kind of found out like Talitha and I both like outdoor activities and exercising, yoga, meditation, hiking, stuff like that. So the platform though did the pairing. I can't take any credit for that, but they and it was kind of then up to us from there. So it was like, okay, here's the mentor, here's the mentee, you know, here's your contact information, and then, you know, do whatever you wish. So we've kind of created a structure for ourselves on how often we meet, like how we communicate, what we do when we meet, And pretty much what works for us is that we meet once a month, every like 4 weeks. We'll have a Zoom call, we'll check in, we'll talk about anything that was like significant that happened. You know, I'll get Talitha's advice on usually school stuff and just ask her any questions that I have that would, you know, she would be able to help me with. And it's kind of just a way for us to kind of check in and stay on track with our goals as well. Because, you know, when you tell the other person last month, you know, I'm working on this, I'll come back the next month and I'll be like, hey, like, how's that going? So it kind of keeps us both accountable. And I think that's really helpful, especially, I mean, right now when like we're not seeing a ton of people. So we kind of have to keep each other accountable. But I think also like the biggest thing is that I've learned so much from the mentorship. And like, it's so interesting because this was a neuroscience platform and I only applied because I was interested in learning more about neuroscience. Like, I don't know like anything about neuroscience at all. So I was just interested to come in as someone, you know, complete beginner, someone who didn't know anything, and just learn from a mentor. And not only have I learned definitely more about neuroscience than I did before, I've learned so many other things as well. Things like, you know, university, because Talitha has so much experience and knowledge in that area. And like, just there are so many things that I can't think off the top of my head right now, but it's so interesting because like we don't study the same subject. So like you guys may know, I'm going into business, Talitha studies neuroscience. They're very different fields, but we're still able to get a lot out of our mentorship in different ways now that we've gotten to know each other a lot more. I think this is a common kind of misconception because when people initially, I don't know if you like would get paired with a mentor or you kind of ask someone and you maybe don't know them as well, it can be a little bit awkward in the beginning because you're still in that getting to know you stage and you might not know things you have in common. So you might want to, you know, quit or stop the mentorship because you feel like, and these are in the initial stages, because you may feel like, oh, I'm really not getting anything out of it, or I don't have anything in common with this person. What could they possibly teach me? And like, what would I be learning? If you're in that situation, I would say to ride it out, like, and wait a little bit longer. You can't give a person like one or two times to show you like everything about them and really get to know them. I would say, you know, meet with them a few more times, have a few more sessions, and really make the most of those sessions. Like, be present, ask them questions, learn about them, learn about what they're doing. Basically learn as much as you can from them. And then after, you can make a fair judgment, because 9 out of 10 times it's going to be a little bit awkward in the beginning. But then once you, you know, start some conversations and you figure out, oh, we both like this, and this is something that we can talk about, and then you build from that common ground, I think the mentorship be so valuable. Like, it's, I can speak for myself in our mentorship relationship. It's been so valuable for me. Like, I've learned so many things just learning and just having someone where I can like not only go for advice, but sometimes I need to be talked down a little bit from things. Like, I will make things a lot bigger than they seem. Like, I couldn't decide on my university, for example, and kind of talked about it, and I really reflected on a lot of the things that we discussed in our conversation, and it helped me make a decision. Like, it, because the decision to me was daunting before we spoke. And we kind of spoke, I got your perspective on it, and then I kind of, things were cleared up in a sense, if that makes sense. So
yeah, that's great.
It's been my first mentorship ever. And I mean, I really enjoy this. I look forward to like even getting other mentors in, you know, different areas as well, because I think it's so valuable to not just have one mentor, like to have people, different perspectives. So if there's anyone is, you know, interested in mentorship slightest bit, and maybe you're unsure about how to go about getting a mentor, look if your school has a program, look if there's like an alumni network, or look online. Even I found this program through social media. You can really find anything online these days. So I would really say go for it. Even if the person is not in your specific field, there's still so much that you can learn from them through a mentorship. But Talitha, I know that you've been a mentor before. This is not your first time mentoring. someone.
No. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's all really good advice. I think, yeah, if I had my time again and I was heading into university, I feel like I would have been a bit more correct than me. So I previously, a few years ago, I got involved in a program called 1,000 Girls, 1,000 Futures. And it's a really good place to go if you're a firstly if you're female, obviously. But if you're looking for a mentor and you're anywhere around the world, they do a yearly program. They have a structured program. So you have a course basically that goes through leadership skills and communication skills and all of these different skills to help like build your like it's professional and personal development, really.
That's
awesome. So yeah, it's a really cool program to get involved in, and it's for it's for under 18s, I think. So it's like 15 to 18 year old girls. So if you have some young listeners, or if you know some people who have got sisters or whatever, and they'd like to be involved in that. So I've done that for a few years and had a few different mentees in that process. But they're it's quite a lot different to this because it's so structured, and each time you meet, again, it's, I think, meeting monthly. We're in summer break, so it's not happening at the moment. Meet monthly and go through the different units of the course that they're doing, and sort of talking about any questions they have, and I share my experience and that sort of thing. But it seems a lot more transactional to some extent than this kind of mentorship, which I feel like because I have seen you so many times with the other one, it's like you might meet with them for two or three times, and then you get another few different mentees, which is lovely because you meet a lot of different people, but at the same time you can't really form that relationship, so it is quite awkward pretty much all the time because every single meeting it's like these teenage girls who are all like, I was super awkward when I was a teenage girl too, so I'm not surprised, but it's like a little bit not really sure. They're not really sure. They're not really talking much because they're super shy. Not always, but yeah, it's different. And I'm really enjoying this. This is probably this is my first proper, what I think I would put in the category of, long-term mentorship and building that relationship and finding common grounds, being able to share experiences. And I get a lot out of the meetings too. So it's definitely not one-sided. I feel like you're saying, keeping us accountable. I just love, and especially with someone from somewhere else in the world as well, it just makes such a difference to learn about how other countries' university systems are working and the different kinds of courses that are available. And
I forgot we'll just talk about like the differences in our world right now. I'll be like, oh, this is what's going on in Canada, what's going on like in Australia right now, and just having a conversation about that. So interesting. And
and just how difficult, I mean, it's socially as well. It doesn't even have to, mentorship doesn't really need to be around, focused goals and professional development every single time. Sometimes it's just a chat about how we're coping with lockdowns and what we're allowed to do and not allowed to do, and graduating in lockdown, and just really trying to understand someone else's perspective and having a sounding board for things that are difficult. So it's been really good. And I mean, I guess I've been involved in lots of informal mentorship as well with PhD students and probably less so honors students, but definitely during my PhD, just going to have coffee with people who are a bit earlier on in their PhD program. And now that I'm past the PhD, I definitely have some people who I see regularly and they're asking you questions about how you cope with this thing or this challenge or whatever, then that's also mentorship.
Yes.
So it can be informal in so many ways. And I think people would be doing it without even realizing as well that there's that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's definitely, if you really took a second to stop and think about it, I'm sure everyone has those people in their lives who, you know, you turn to for advice, or you just want to like always run your thoughts and ideas by. Those are, in a sense, informal mentors.
That is.
Yeah, mentorship is so prevalent in our lives, whether or not we realize it. But I think it's such an asset, you know, in any, whatever you're doing. I think the more people you have in your life who you can learn from and get a different perspective on various topics, I think it's just more of an asset always than it is, you know, something else.
I was also going to say, you're never too old to have a mentor as well, because it's every single, I shouldn't say never too old, possibly could be, you know, when you're really, really old. But in terms of career stages, I've had different types, formal and informal, over.
If you're older, maybe you have, like, say, the example that's coming to my head right now is technology. What if you have, like, a younger person who teaches you and mentors you, like, with technology and using that? That could be, like, a form of mentorship, maybe.
That's a good point. I don't think it doesn't necessarily, mentorship doesn't have to be about age and career stage. It's more about learning things, learning new things and different ways of doing things.
Yes. And when I think just like, I really like looking at it with that lens, like just defined by age or defined by, like, you know, anything. Just I'm here in this relationship or mentorship to learn, and no matter situation, I'm here because I'm going to get something and learn something from the other person, and maybe I can teach them something. I think when we look at it like that, that's really good mentorship, because we're going in with the right mindset.
Yeah, it's a good point. Maybe you could teach me how to do a podcast.
Great though, you did really, really great. Like, such great insight, so much good information. Like, thank you so much for coming on, honestly.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Yeah, it was really fun.
Okay, everyone, that is it for my conversation with Talitha. I had such a fun time recording it. I really like the topics that we talked about in this episode. I mean, I always learn when I talk to Talitha, and I hope that you guys learned a thing or two as well that you can apply to your daily lives. As always, you know the drill. Remember to subscribe, follow, rate, and review the podcast if you enjoyed this episode and if you're excited for more episodes to come. As well, you can always follow the podcast on social media. The Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook username is @TheSitDownWithSteph, and the username for the Twitter account is @TheSitDownWith1. Thank you again for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you will join me again next time. Bye for now.